Okay, thank you, members, for your patience. We ended the committee, our last committee that was in here, about the time we were supposed to start, so I appreciate your patience. And if you can all help us get through, make up time in this committee so that we don't have to come back, that would be wonderful. So I'm called the meeting of the House of Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee meeting to order. There is a quorum present. May I have a motion to approve the March 6, 2019 minutes?
So moved.
Okay, thank you, Representative Vang. Representative Vang moves approval of the minutes for March 6, 2019. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails, and minutes for March 6, 2019 are approved. We have Representative Richardson here today to do our first bill, and I will move that House File 1957 be referred to Judiciary and Civil Law. And I understand that there is an author's amendment, so maybe we just should get that in order. It's labeled H1957A1 to put the bill in the form the author wants. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion passes. Welcome to the committee, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So House File 1957 would codify language related to data practices for post-secondary students. There are four sections with changes proposed in this legislation related to data practices. And Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education is here to walk through those changes with the committee.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. Ms. Grimes, proceed.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Tricia Grimes. I'm with the Office of Higher Education. So House File 1957 are the data practices provisions of the Office of Higher Education's housekeeping policy bill. The same provisions are also in House File 2054, but we put the data practices provisions in a separate bill so that it can go on its way to civil law and be heard there. Is supposed to happen with data practices provisions. Section 1 is a cross-reference. It's actually an amendment to Section 13, which is the data practices part of Minnesota statute, and it says that data collected from student complaints are governed by Sections EN-136A.672 that we are adding. Section 2 is an amendment to 136A that defines that makes it clear that financial records, student complaint data, and reports, except for accreditation reports, are defined as private data. It was the advice of the Department of Administration data practices folks that we get clarification on this. They agreed with us that this already was private data, but they said we should get clarification in the law, so that is what we are seeking to do. And then there's similar language in Section 3 and Section 4. Are there any questions?
Members, any questions? Seeing no questions, would you like to make further comment on your bill, Representative Richardson?
Thank you, Ms. Madam Chair. I'd just like to ask for support.
Okay. All those in favor of... I renew my motion to move House File 1957 as amended to the Judiciary and Civil Law and refer to Judiciary and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Richardson.
Oh, I should have asked. I didn't ask.
Okay, now we move on to Representative Vang's bill, and I will let her move her motion to her bill to the General Register when she takes a seat.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move my House File 2054 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Excellent. And And you are you going to do an author's amendment to start with?
Yes. Okay. I would like to move my author's amendment to
Well, you can just your author's amendment label A19-0136 to be put in the bill.
Yes.
The form that you want. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion passes. Now, there's a second author's amendment to adopt the language we just adopted in House Bill 1957. Would you like to move that?
Yes, so moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, so the author's amendment labeled H2054A1 to be put in the bill in the form that the author wants is now moved by Representative Bang. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. The motion passes. Okay, now we can get started. Please proceed, Representative Bang.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm happy to present to you today House File 2054, which is the Office of Higher Ed Agency Bill. This bill makes a variety of technical changes and adds some provisions regarding consumer protection for students in for-profit and not-for-profit schools. The First Amendment is just a cross-reference to the definition on private data individuals in the Minnesota Statute, Section 13.02. Subdivision 12, and then the A19-0136 amendment just adds the aviation education loan forgiveness language to the bill, similar to the language that we heard in last week's committee. And I do have Tricia here with me today. If you have any questions, and many of these, I would like to note that many of these provisions did pass both chambers in last session, and it was vetoed in the omnibus prime bill.
Okay, and we have testifiers today, and Ms. Grimes, will you be starting?
Madam Chair, okay. Yes, the plan is for, I'm Tricia Grimes with the Office of Higher Education, and the plan is for me to testify and then call on my colleagues as needed if there are questions from the committee that are deeper that I can, than I can answer. I will proceed fairly quickly, section by section, through the bill, if that's all right with the chair, and please stop me if you have questions along the way. Section 1 is one of the data practices provisions, exactly the same as the bill we just did in House File 1957. Section 2 amends the Teacher Candidate Grant Program Statute to clarify how intent to teach in a shortage area may be documented, and it also clarifies that an underrepresented racial or ethnic group is one which is underrepresented in the Minnesota teacher workforce. And that underrepresented status, we rely on what is now the Professional Educator License and Standard Board, HELSBE, used to be the Board of Teaching, to define that. Section 3 is also about teacher candidate grants. It amends the program to strike language regarding repayment responsibilities for recipients who do not fill the teaching obligation. It is extremely difficult for the Office of Higher Education to pursue borrowers who go out of state to repay such a teaching obligation, and so we are asking to strike that language. It also clarifies again that an underrepresented racial or ethnic group is one underrepresented in the Minnesota teacher workforce. Section 4 on self-loans has to do with the eligible student definition. We are basically repealing the definition of eligible student that is later in statute and moving it up to the front of the student loan statutes, so that it's right up in front where everybody knows that it applies to all of the loans in that section. Section 5 on self-loans is a cross-reference, and you'll see several changes in these statutes to cross-references. In 2016, the legislature gave the Office of Higher Education authority to do self-refinancing loans, called self-refi. And these changes and cross-references make sure that the self-refi statutes are included in the list of statutes that apply to the self-loan and self-refi loan programs. Very technical amendment. Section 6 is also on self-loans, and it amends the subdivision regarding OHE's rules and policies for administering student loan programs and removes a reference to a federal loan program that no longer exists. Section 7 through 10 are more of those changes and cross-references to include the self-refi program. Section 11 strikes repayment procedures for supplemental loans and inserts a cross-reference to OHE general rules and policies for student loan programs and this allows OHE to provide more flexible repayment term to borrowers. So, for example, in earlier iteration of self-loans, we did not have quite as much flexibility for borrowers who may have some reason that they are not repaying, such as temporary total disability, and that had the effect of amounting to a balloon payment because the current law says that in no event shall the repayment period exceed 15 years. We learned with newer iterations of the loan program that that actually was not always helpful to borrowers, that balloon payment actually would sometimes contribute to defaults. And trying to make sure that we have all, as many as possible borrowers repaying on time and avoiding defaults helps us when we go to get to sell municipal bonds, revenue bonds, to provide the loan capital for this program. Section 12 relates to private and out-of-state schools and amends the list of information that the schools must provide with registering in the Office of Higher Education to include the school's disclosure that to students that the student complaint process exists. Then Section 13 clarifies, and this is one of the data practices provisions that was also in House Bill 1957, clarifies that student complaint data are private. Section 14 requires a school to disclose information regarding the student complaint process. And so we want them to have it in their website, in their handbook. Make sure that students know that if they have a complaint that is not, they feel is not adequately addressed by the school, that they cannot complain to the Office of Higher Education, and we will investigate that complaint. Madam Chair, did you want me to pause? Okay.
No, you're fine.
All right. Section 15 amends the requirements for when a school intends to close. Basically, this takes policies and procedures the Office of Higher Education has to try to protect students when an institution is closing and puts those policies and procedures into statute where they're right up in front where everyone can see them. Section 16 clarifies that new schools without accreditation must provide a surety bond equal to 10% of net annual net revenue from tuition fees. And for registered institutions that fall below certain federal minimum financial standards, it adds an option for those schools to provide a reduced surety bond. These bonds help provide security to the Office of Higher Education to help pay for teach outs and accommodations for students if a school should happen to close. And this is actually a lower cost way for some of the schools to provide that kind of security. Section 17 is another one of the data practices provisions that we discussed in the previous bill. Section 18 adds a definition of clock hour. Some of the schools, particularly cosmetology schools, do not use credit hours. They use clock hours. This defines how they are, how clock hours work. Section 19 adds a definition of student record. When a school goes out of business, the Office of Higher Education ends up with the transcripts and records from the students that attended that school, and later on those students may need to get a copy of those transcripts to prove their education when getting a job or when transferring to another school. And so this defines what has to be included in those student records that the Office of Higher Education receives. Section 20 corrects technical accounting terminology, changing the word income to revenue, which to accountants and auditors makes a difference. So we're going along with how they advised us on that. Section 21 also is about disclosure of the student complaint process in the catalog, brochure, or electronic display. Section 22 is another set of things about the student record, because they're, the first part of these statutes have to do with schools that offer degrees, and the second part have to do with schools that offer shorter-term programs that result in diplomas or certificates. Again, Section 23 is a requirement for when a school intends to close. 24 is disclosing information about student complaints. 25 is the data practices information we discussed in the previous bill. And 26 amends language in the appropriation for the emergency assistance to post-secondary students to clarify that eligible institutions must be located in Minnesota. It also deletes language requiring that the grant award will not impact the student's state financial aid award, which conflicts with federal law. And then the repealers. I'm almost done here. Section 136A.15 sub 2 repeals language academic year or its equivalent that is actually referring to an obsolete federal loan program. 136A.15 sub 7 repeals that definition of eligible lender that we moved up to the front of the statute. And 136A.1701 sub 12 repeals a definition of eligible student that actually relates to prior to 1988 when the office was a student loan lender on the old federal guaranteed student loan program. So it's quite obsolete. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to try and answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Does anybody have any questions? Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess my question would be to you. So in regards to Subdivision 6, which is lines 11.3 and 4, Subdivision 19, which is 11.15 through 19, and then Section 25, Subdivision 7, which is line 16.11 through 13, it's referencing private information, student record, and because the cross-reference looks like it's 136A, I suspect this would not be going to the Judiciary Committee because it's not Chapter 13. And so just can you confirm if my understanding is correct?
Okay, so when you started the question, I didn't realize you were asking me that question. So could you please repeat your question? Because right now we're planning on it going to the General Register, and is that what you're asking?
That answers my question, Madam Chair. Right. So first question anyway.
Okay, and I just want to say one thing, is that we need to make clear the motion that was originally made to make sure that, probably withdraw it and make it say it again just to make sure that we're doing it properly. And when I get to that, I'll let you know how to do that. Okay, so Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then my question for the bill author or the testifier would be, when looking at line, let's just say 16.11 through 13, for example, referencing complaint data and then law enforcement, because this is making a change that says student complaint data are private, does that mean that complaint data presently under 136A.8295 is public in some capacity?
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, if it's all right, I'm going to ask Betsy Talbot from the Office of Higher Education Consumer Protection staff to answer that question.
Sure. So, for the record, I'm Betsy Talbot. I work for the Office of Higher Education. I'm responsible for the state authorization, which is the licensing and registration process. Currently, they are currently considered private. So there is no actual change. We're just making it explicit and very clear. And we already have to provide that information in the event of litigation if we're subpoenaed. And so none of that process or rights or of the people who are the data is about is changing.
Representative Zero.
Since nothing is effectively changing from presently public to private, then I have no further questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Other questions for member? Representative, Vice Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the section on post-secondary institutions closing, we know that recently there has been a proprietary school that's closed. And does this change anything about the process that happened when that closed or the different than it has been in currently?
Madam Chair, Grimes. Representative Pryor, no, this puts current practice on helping students when a student is closed into statutes. It's already been in our policies and procedures, but this puts it into statute.
Vice Chair Pryor.
And just a brief follow-up, just for my own information, what happens to a student's academic record when an institution is closed?
Madam Chair, the Office of Higher Education goes and seizes the transcripts, the student records, and houses them at the Office of Higher Education, and the Office of Higher Education then provides copies of those transcripts upon request to the students. Madam Chair, perhaps Betsy Talbot can elaborate.
Ms. Talbot.
Representative, I was wondering if you could clarify what portion of the student record you're referring to. Are you referring to, like, student financial aid record or...
Vice Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what I was thinking of first is if you wanted to have your transcript, your grades forwarded to a future employer and to another institution, if that record would still be available.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, so we do. We do take all of the records. We are the default record holder in the event they don't have an alternate school to take them. And we've been very successful in the state of Minnesota to ensure that we have those records. So in the case of Argosy, we actually got them early, and we're expecting another batch this week for students who were able to have their grades recorded on Friday.
Thank you, Ms. Talbot. Okay, thank you. Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a comment, actually, for the author, and a compliment, actually. Thank you for including my loan forgiveness program for aviation in your bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other question, members, or any members' questions? Okay. With that, would you like to withdraw your original motion and make a new motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to withdraw my motion to labor for inclusion and make a new motion to send House File 2054 as amended to the General Registrar.
Okay. And I just want to ask our counsel here, do we need to renew the motion now that we just did it before we're voting on it?
Madam Chair and members, the new motion before the committee is to refer House File 2054 to the General Register. So
as amended?
As amended, yes.
And you included that in yours, yes. As amended? Okay, thank you very much. Great job. Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to have Vice Chair Pryor take over this next bill, and thank you.
The next bill we're going to hear is 2100. Mm-hmm. Representative Wolgamuth. Okay. Representative Wolgamuth, would you like to move that House File 2100 be laid over for possible inclusion?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative, you may present your bill.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. I'm here today to present House File 2100 to continue some important work in the areas of spinal cord and traumatic brain injury research that our state is very smartly invested in 2015. The current program is managed out of the Office of Higher Education with a 14-member council of spinal cord injury and traumatic brain injury experts, veterans, and community members. Since 2015, 39 grants have been awarded, totaling $6.8 million that's been awarded with a focus on functional recovery and rehabilitative techniques for these two conditions that cause lifelong disabilities that deeply affect individuals and their families. These grants have been awarded to junior and senior investigators from the University of Minnesota, Mayo Clinic, top hospitals, and several medical device companies here in Minnesota. Members, this really is an exceptional program in that we have fostered a public-private partnership with the funds that the state invested. In many instances, this state support has been used as seed funding to get researchers in place, to develop their research ideas, get them started, attract federal, foundational, and industry investment to accelerate groundbreaking research right here in our home state. Minnesota is a world-class leader in the medical community, being home to Mayo Clinic, University of Minnesota, and leading medical device companies. And I believe additional state funding could bring extensive research dollars to our state. This has been proven in 14 other states, which are funding similar grant programs on their own and are developing breakthrough avenues of research. This is important because current market forces are not adequate for some of this research because of the low population and lower return on investment compared to larger health issues such as diabetes, heart disease, cancer. This funding could also save significant dollars in the future if we're able to develop treatments to help individuals living with SCI and TBI in Minnesota. Members, almost 11,000 people in Minnesota suffer from a spinal cord injury. And healthcare costs for those individuals range between $65,000 and $140,000 per year. Minnesota is making a shift in the pace of research to develop needed treatments that would not have happened without this important grant program. So in closing, in summary, the bill seeks to add appropriations on top of the $3 million allocated per year to help increase the ability of the program to fund good research proposals. For some context, since the program started, 39 out of 73 grant requests have been awarded, leaving many good ideas and opportunities left behind. And with that, Madam Chair and members, I would like to give it over to my testifiers who are here today.
All right. And who will be our first testifier? All right. Will you state your name for the record?
My name is Dr. Isabel Scaresbrook.
And you may begin.
First, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Council, for the opportunity to address the pressing need for spinal cord and traumatic brain injury research in the state of Minnesota. As I mentioned, my name is Isabel Scaresbrook, and I'm the director of a program for neural repair at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. From my perspective, there are a number of important features that make the Minnesota SCI and TBI funding program unique and of high value to the state of Minnesota and to the ultimate progress of spinal cord and traumatic brain injury research nationwide. First, I run a discovery science research lab at the Mayo Clinic that focuses on identification of new strategies to promote neural repair. I really see firsthand the life-altering impact of spinal cord and traumatic brain injury and the urgent need felt by patients and their families to find new therapies that will restore function. Many of these injuries result in life-altering permanent disabilities, and there's no doubt that we need to find new and better ways to heal the injured brain and spinal cord. Unlike many other tissues of our body, the brain and the spinal cord that comprise the central nervous system have a very limited capacity for spontaneous repair. However, if we are able to find ways to elicit repair and regeneration of these cells, we can truly make a difference in the lives of patients. Running a research lab, I recognize the ongoing need for research funds, not only to sustain projects to the point of clinical translation, but also to permit new pilot studies of untested ideas that may hold the key to successful treatments in the future. Importantly, I have actually been the beneficiary of state funding and have seen its direct impact on my research program and that of my colleagues at the Mayo Clinic, the University of Minnesota, health partners, and other institutions statewide. In my own program, these funds have enabled new collaborative efforts with scientists at the Stem Cell Institute at the University of Minnesota. These collaborations have resulted in new preliminary data that's enabled us to apply for larger grants from the National Institutes of Health and other foundations. Just to describe one small thing that we discovered, we showed that removal of a very common blood protein referred to as thrombin, which some of you may have heard of, this actually unleashes considerable plasticity and rewiring in the injured spinal cord, resulting in recovery of function in experimental animal models. This is really exciting because there's already FDA-approved drugs to target this protein, and these could ultimately be repurposed for repair of the central nervous system alone or in conjunction with other therapies if our studies continue to show promise. In addition to driving cross-institutional collaboration, The state funding enables investigators to hire and train the next generation of spinal cord and traumatic brain injury research scientists. This includes funding of technical staff to complete research projects that then become well-trained in the science of studying these devastating conditions in human subjects and in experimental animal systems. The Minnesota state grants also often include funding for postdoctoral scientists and therefore effectively enable training of the scientific workforce of the future that will be poised to make the next transformative discoveries to drive forward the development of new therapies. It can't really be underestimated that it takes significant training to successfully study spinal cord and traumatic brain injury in a rigorous fashion. So having funding to include not only scientific and clinical staff, but also trainees is essential to raising the level of scientific discovery in the state of Minnesota. It is really, I think, at these early formative stages of their career that we can get young scientists interested in these very difficult but highly clinically relevant research problems. By facilitating training, the state funds are proving to be instrumental in elevating the level of science in the state of Minnesota in general and in building a well-trained scientific workforce of the future. There is no doubt in my mind that the dollars invested now will reap many rewards down the road. It is both the discoveries that this funding enables and the workforce training that will serve to meet the healthcare needs of Minnesota patients in the future. Ultimately, we hope that these funds will help position the state of Minnesota as a critical center for spinal cord and traumatic brain injury research that has a reputation for quality and discovery that rivals that already exists on the east and west coasts of the United States. I wanted to mention that in the past, I served on the SCI and TBI State Research Council for a two-year term. Therefore, I have seen how this very unique panel of scientists, physicians, veterans, and consumers come together to advocate for high-quality spinal cord and traumatic brain injury research right here in the state of Minnesota. This is highly unique, as many study sections that perform peer review for research grants consist primarily of research scientists. Therefore, the SCI and TBI Research Council fosters not only funding of excellent science, but also that which the spinal cord and TBI patient and clinical community think is most relevant to their needs. I think it's very important to articulate that although SCI and TBI are among the major contributors to disability in North America, that they are highly underfunded relative to other causes of disability and other health care conditions. Therefore, I believe the state funds are in many cases absolutely critical to enable research in the fields of spinal cord and traumatic brain injury to occur in the first place. In addition, we need scientists focused on these highly challenging conditions. There's a true danger of losing the best scientific minds to other areas that receive more funding from the National Institutes of Health, such as aging. From a practical standpoint, I've seen how the Minnesota state funds to date have been instrumental in attracting new scientists to the field and to maintaining top talent focused on the very difficult problems of spinal cord and traumatic brain injury. Finally, I've seen how the state research dollars have not only driven new ideas clinically, new lines of clinically relevant research that are already impacting patient lives, but have also led to the discovery of new targets for repair of the central nervous system that consumers need to make a lasting difference to reduce disability and improve quality of life. I thank you for the time to express the urgent need for these state research dollars, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Further testifiers? Representative Wolgamut? Yes, thank you.
All right, Madam Chairman and Committee, thank you for letting me come and testify about the benefits that I have seen from this research that has been done. I am currently a client of the
Will you state your name for the record?
Oh, Lynn Wolf, the animal.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Wolf.
Yep. I am currently a client in the East Stand trial at the University of Minnesota, led by David Darrow. It'll be 9 years ago this Friday. I was downhill skiing, and I wasn't wearing a helmet, and I hit a tree. It happens. I broke a lot of things, including but not limited to my skull and my back. So I am paralyzed from the middle of the chest downward. I had 4 surgeries in the first month after my accident, and I've had 8 in the following years. May 30th of last year, I had an epidural stimulation device implanted in my spinal cord to help reinitiate voluntary muscle movement as well as regain autonomic functions. And you may not think about things like this, but I ended up having low blood pressure from my spinal cord injury. And with this stimulator, I've had much better blood pressure control. So I have far fewer days where I have a lightheaded spell and I feel like I'm going to pass out. I also never, after I got hurt, I did not sweat from down here, down below, and now my legs and my chest do sweat, so I have much better body temperature control. And finally, my bowel program has improved dramatically. It has gone from taking 45 minutes in the morning to complete to about 10 minutes, and I find myself with more time in the morning because I'm used to it taking so much longer. My day is much improved. In terms of volitional improvements of voluntary muscle movement, first, I have more feeling in my legs. Like, I can, in the shower, I can feel the warmth or the coolness of the water on my legs, and that is something I never had before, and I have lots of little burns on my legs, if you wanted to see proof that I couldn't feel it. And secondly, I have much better control of the muscles in my legs. I can voluntarily kick my right leg, and I get more knee-to-chest movement with my left with the stimulator on in certain settings, and I would be more than happy to show you guys. Who wants to see? Yeah, all right. So one of my favorite parts about all of this is, you want to know how I control it? There's an app for that. Yeah, there's an app for that. So I turn it on. There are a lot of different settings for muscle movement, but I do have my favorites, and this is one of them. I had absolutely no voluntary muscle movement before. Oh, come on. Be nice. There we go. I still talk to my legs. And now they're tired. But, like, I get more movements, and it is very nice. I would love to be able to stand and to walk again, but having a much better control of my blood pressure and knowing I'm not going to overheat are way better for me personally. And I owe that all to the e-stand, which she is going to tell you about. So thank you, and if you have any questions.
Thank you.
My name is Shivani Venkatesh. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak about my experiences with the benefits of this program, which has enhanced my college experience and career. I joined the Brain Injury Research Lab at Hennepin Healthcare when I was a freshman, and I was a volunteer, and now I'm currently working there as a research assistant. And I have been involved in many different studies, from classifying and better diagnosing brain injuries. For example, using the eye tracker, which is a diagnostic tool where people just watch a video move around the screen, and an infrared camera actually tracks the pupil coordinates. And people who have sustained brain injuries often have disconjugate eye movements. So as visual impairments are so frequent after head injury, this non-invasive tool has the ability to quickly assess symptoms of concussion, which could lead to faster treatment. And the eye tracker has actually just been recently FDA approved to detect concussion. Another study is the vagus nerve stimulation, which is a non-invasive device that stimulates the vagus nerve. It has been FDA approved to treat epilepsy and depression, and we're working to see if this can also treat symptoms of TBI as well. And as Lynn mentioned, I am also working on the e-stand trial, which hopes to bring back volitional and autonomic movement to people who have sustained spinal cord injuries. I recently started to work on this project, but I have already seen the impact of this research, and I have seen people like Lynn voluntarily move their legs many years after sustaining this injury. And another nice thing about ESTAN is that it's very personalized, so each of the settings are personalized for all the subjects in the study, so it is not generalized. So since I've joined this lab, many students have participated in this crucial research, which has given all of us the opportunity to interact with healthcare professionals, perform assessments on subjects, present at conferences, work on publications, and more. In fact, because of this lab, I will be presenting research on eye tracking and psychological outcomes after brain injuries at an international conference in Canada, and this is something I never would have imagined I'd be able to do as a freshman. Overall, this lab is the reason why I want to pursue medicine. The skills I've learned from conducting research have been incredibly beneficial both to my career and education. The state funds have been extremely beneficial to not only me, but to so many other people of varying education levels, which is why it should be continued and expanded to create more opportunities for students like myself and others.
Thank you. Final testifier. You'd state your name for the record, please. Yeah.
My name is Rob Woodlick. I've got obstetric secure paralysis, and I also serve on the state council for this program. Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, Madam Chair, thank you for allowing us the opportunity to present and hear us today and consider our this really important bill that is important to myself and others and my condition. And it's really made a huge difference in the past few years, and you can see today that it is. We've really come a long ways since 2015 when this program started, and it's really impressive, and with the help of this committee, it's great. So I did some research. Some of the questions that I was getting were about, you know, what's going to healthcare. It's about 50-50 from higher education to healthcare institutes, and then about 2% is going to industry. So a lot of the healthcare institutions also employ undergrad and graduate students and postdocs that are in education and collaborating with the university and Mayo Clinic. So this program is bringing in industry, outside partnerships with other leading researchers, and even attracting researchers to move to Minnesota. So sometimes from California. So I don't know why, but yeah. So thank you for hearing us today, and hope that you consider expanding this program so we can help more and more good ideas and researchers and institutions. Thank you.
I think at this time, if we have any testifiers from the public, from the audience that would like to come down, and then we'll, if you can stay also for questions from the members. Anyone else that would like to testify? Sorry, we have to musical chairs. If you would state your name for the record, please.
My name is Eric Malky.
And could you spell your name?
It's M-I-E-L-K-E.
Thank you.
Okay. My name is Eric Malky. I'm a citizen advocate with the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance. I also have a brain injury. I suffered my first brain injury from meningitis when I was 3 years old. I had near-death experience at the hospital. I suffered my second brain injury from a car accident. The man who hit me was going down the wrong way on Highway 62, and he was high on cannabis. Thank you for the hearing on HF-2100 and supporting research for brain injury and spinal cord injuries.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Malky. We have questions from members. Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is probably going to the Office of Higher Education. Just wondering, so this grant is administered by them. Is that is that common? I mean, are there many grant programs that are administered by the Office of Higher Education? And how many scientists are currently receiving grants? Is there a website that's maintained? And
Madam Chair, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. This is one of a number of what we call pass-through programs that the Office of Higher Education administers, where we receive the funds. And then in this case, there is a competitive grant process that determines the awarding of funds. Madam Chair, if it's acceptable, I'd like to ask my colleague Elena DeSalvo to speak to this.
Thank you. If you would state your right name for the record.
Sure, hello.
Please. And spell your name.
My name is Elena DeSalvo, A-L-A-I-N-A, DeSalvo, D-E-S-A-L-V-O.
Thank you.
I am the competitive grant manager at the Office of Higher Education. Madam Chair, to answer some of your questions, I manage about six competitive grant programs. This is the only grant program that has a research and science like content area. The others are centered on education, higher education, and also K-12. I'm sorry, can you repeat the questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
And Mr. Salvo, just wondering how many scientists currently receive the grant? Are any of them in the private sector, or is it somewhat difficult for private sector to,
sure,
you know?
Madam Chair. Oh, sure, sorry. There are quite a few scientists who currently receive funding for this program, including the scientists that are involved on the principal investigator teams. I don't have the exact number handy, but I mean, we fund, you know, as was mentioned, research happening at the Mayo Clinic, at the University of Minnesota, Hennepin Healthcare, and several other institutions, including, thank you, I wrote this. Including some private sector organizations. For example, we did award a grant to a company called Abilitech Medical. It's a medical device company. Private sector institutions are welcome to apply, and they are judged on the same criteria as nonprofit institutions such as hospitals and schools.
And Madam Chair, just one follow-up. Sir, with what frequency then are the grant recipients reporting, or are they? Is there a monitoring,
yes,
of how they're coming?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
So we do have two reports annually that that all the grant recipients have to submit. We have an interim report which talks about progress made on the project, and then we have a final report when the project is complete. We'll do interim reports annually until the project is complete. The final report just talks about the entire process, including results such as some of the things we've seen today, any publications, and other involvements that the investigators have been a part of as a result of this project. We also do, I remember that you mentioned asking a question about a website. We do have a website. We have a report that I generate annually as well that has summaries of each funded program, who was involved in each program, how much was awarded to each institution, as well as some results.
Representative Runbeck and Dr. Scarbrick, if you could, the information that you were providing to Representative Runbeck, you could provide the rest of the committee at a later date, after the meeting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I have a follow-up to that, to Representative Runbeck. When we
and Mr. Whitlam.
Sorry, my name's Rob Woodlick.
Yeah.
Okay. When we formulated this program back in 2015, we intentionally formed it under the Office of Higher Education with consumers as part of the committee, to, along with experts, to formulate a results-driven program. And that's, I think that's a huge part of the success of this program. This committee does fund a lot of specific research programs to go to Mayo Clinic and the university. And, because this was a grassroots campaign, we chose the Office of Higher Education to work with. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Daniels?
I also had a follow-up point. After the first couple of years of funding, the council actually organized a statewide SEI and TBI research symposium where all of the investigators who had been given funding were invited to attend, including their students and research teams. And this was open to the public because we really wanted to disseminate the information that of the great research that has been enabled by this program. And I do believe a few of the state legislators also attended. And so I think that was a great way to kind of disseminate the information.
And I do have to let the committee know that we are getting a little bit short on time, and so I hope we can move through our questions as quickly as possible. Thank you. And Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a quick comment. Rob, we've been seeing each other for about 4 years, and I'm just wondering how your progress is coming. You're looking good.
Yeah.
And have a little more mobility, but maybe if you could just explain that.
Well, I participate in adaptive fitness quite a bit, 3 days a week sometimes, and I've been doing that since my injury. And so thanks to that, when I first was injured, I was on a ventilator, and all I could do was shoulder shrugs. And after being in a chair for almost 8 years, I am starting to feed myself. Yesterday, I gave myself a full cup of pudding. And 2 weeks ago, I wrote my name for the first time in a couple of years. So, but I want to see more, from this research. So, thank you.
Thanks. Madam Chair, just one quick little follow-up comment. I can relate in a very small way. When I was 37, I had a brain surgery, and I came out in a wheelchair. So I have new understanding for that, and had to do the rehab. And I know they call them physical therapists, but I call them physical torturists. but they will make you work, and I'm glad to see the progress you made. It's just wonderful. Just keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Daniels. And I believe one more question, Representative Lehman.
Thank you. Make it just a really direct, straightforward question, and this is to the author, Representative Wilgema. I'm just curious as to how you came up with the amount of the request, $2 million in 2020, $2 million in 2021.
I'll defer to my testifier.
Okay. So when we've always asked for a total of $10 million for this program. And so when the bill was written, it was $2 million per year. We are requesting $3 million, $3 million total, so 1.5 per year actually, but because of the timing of the bill that was written, and didn't get an amendment in on time, so we could do an amendment today on that or refer to a future hearing on that, but it's also a number at this point, I believe, so. Mm-hmm. It's an estimate of what we're asking. Yes. So,
we do have the bill. The motion is to lay it over for possible inclusion, and amounts can change in the future. Hearing no further discussion, Representative Wolgmut will renew the motion that House File 2100 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education Omnibus Bill. The motion passes. Okay.
Thank you.
I don't have
to work.
Okay.
And then you'll send us off?
Yeah.
Send it to the CA. Sean. Yeah.
All right.
You have a nice job. Sorry, I didn't keep jumping.
Oh, I couldn't see his name.
Thank you. We have Representative Poppy. And Representative Poppy, will you move that House File 1779 be laid over?
Thank you. Yes, House File 1779 to be laid over, hopefully to be included in the future bill, and I'll describe that a little bit. House File 1779 is a request to increase what are considered the agriculture special appropriations, or the ag specials. And the reason why we are doing this is because it's a number of years since we've actually had any change in the ag specials through the University of Minnesota. And actually, the last time it was changed, it was a deduction. It was reduced. So that's what I'm going to describe the bill. Just want to give you a little bit of history about the ag specials, and actually the University of Minnesota is a land-grant university, and in its origins, when it became a land-grant university, that required the university to do three things. It was required to provide military tactics and agriculture and mechanical arts. Those are the three things that a land-grant university is supposed to be involved in. It wasn't until the 1930s when the military tactics, they no longer, the regents determined that they were no longer going to do that, but there was a continuation for agriculture and certainly mechanical arts. And we think about liberal arts, we hear about that, but this is to think about more of the hands-on approach to doing, to learning about occupations that people could be employed in. Since the early 1900s, the university has carved out, had special appropriations related to agriculture over the course of a number of years. Those appropriations have adjusted. They've been in different formats, and they've actually been line items in the University of Minnesota budget. But since the late 70s, probably early 80s, they actually started to format the appropriations in groupings. And so even though for a number of years there was an extension special line item, and there was also line item for ag research and other things, they were kind of grouped together. And that's so in 1984 and 85 we started to see that they were included a little bit more together. So what we're doing is asking for, what I'd like to see happen, is to have an increase. I've got a testifier here who's going to be able to provide a little bit more context about the ag special and kind of where it's been in the last 20 years. So I'm going to have him speak to the issue, and then I'll describe the bill a little bit more in detail.
Thank you. And Mr. Testifier, would you please state your name for the record?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Bruce Clavin. I'm an ag lobbyist chair. I work for a number of groups. For the record, you can put me down for Minnesota wheat growers. I also work for the barley growers, potatoes, sugar beets, turkey, beef cattle, and some others. I'm also speaking on behalf today for some of our ag coalition members instead of getting them all up here, the Farm Bureau, the Farmers Union, corn, soybeans, pork, and others. So it's a group, and we're all supporting this effort. And we thank our ag chair, Representative Poppy, for picking up this issue. It's something that's important to all our groups, so it's appropriate that she takes it, and we want to thank you for that. I was in preparation for the hearing, I went back 20 years. I just picked 20 years because that seemed like a decent number. And back in 1999, during the 99 budget year, the Ag Special was funded at $57.58 million. So in the 20-year period between then and now, that's a 25% reduction. And the reduction actually occurred in 2011 during that budget year. In 2011, we went down to $42.9 million, and it's been there ever since. Meanwhile, the O&M budget, the total appropriation from the legislature to the university, has gone up in that same time period, 19, almost 20%. Okay, so if you break it down, you go back to 1999, the total appropriation to the U was $585 million and some change. In 2011, by 2011, it dropped down, but now it sits at 660, and the second year last year was 650. And so as a percentage of that total budget, in 1999, the Ag Special was 9.5% of the total budget at the U, and now it is down to 6.5, and it has been that way for a number of years. And so we think it's time to have that go up after all those years as a percentage. I would also let members know, and probably a lot of you don't know this, that those groups that I mentioned, including the ones that I work for directly, most of them have what are called checkoffs. So, for example, there's a wheat checkoff. It's a penny or two a bushel. That goes into a council, and it's run by farmer members who cut up that money for primarily research. It can also be used for promotion. So the money that you see in the bill is leveraged privately by our grower groups. The soybean growers have a checkoff, the corn growers have a checkoff, the pork producers have a checkoff. And so when we need research projects, we will go to the U and offer to partner with them with our checkoff dollars. And so I want to make the point to the members that there's more going on here than just the ag specialists, the partnering with the private individual growers, acting through their councils. And I'll take any questions you have, Madam Chair. Thank you.
I have a question. So are there now, is university refusing some of the research projects because they don't have, they can't match the checkoff money that's coming from the groups?
Sure, Madam Chair. I don't know that they're refusing projects in and of itself. I think probably part of the effort here, and we see this over in Representative Poppy's committee, we have new, I don't know if I'd call them demands, but new directions that people want us to go out on the farm, cover crops, pennycress, other things, the Forever Green Institute. She has bills that are over in her committee asking for research on cover crops and soil health and so forth. And so it wouldn't be so much that the corn growers or the wheat growers' checkoff is being refused. It's that we're going in a different direction. And so we need to up that effort, whether it's water quality or soil quality or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And I know that we'll have a question and for this testifier, or would should we return to the bill for this testifier? Thank you. One more question then.
Thank
please.
You, Madam Chair. So it sounds like
Representative
this,
Rumbeck.
This thank is, you. Thank you, Madam Chair, an ongoing program. Money's been around for a while, but this is entirely new language, so I don't understand why it's all new.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Poppy.
Go ahead. So what we're doing is we're requesting, so some of it is continued language, but what we're asking to do is increase the ag specialists by $10 million, and of those $10 million, to have them split in four different ways. So if I can just go through the bill a little bit.
Thank you, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to have four different initiatives, $2.5 million each year for the Forever Green Initiative. That has been something that's been funded, and again, it's been funded kind of through the ag budget to the university. So it's kind of trying to clean that up a little bit and have it go directly to the university. So $2.5 million for Forever Green, $2.5 for the Ag Research Education Extension and Technology Transfer Program. That's also known as AGREET, AGREET. And that has been something we have funded most recently. So it's going to give them some ongoing dollars again, so it's directly to the ag specials and not being routed through the Department of Ag and through the ag budget. $2.5 each year for the Minnesota Extension Regional Economic Sustainability Programming, and they do a lot of work with good food access and fund to school kinds of things and really encouraging that growth of that market, and that's been something that's been ongoing. But they reach out in all parts of greater Minnesota, so not in the metropolitan area, but every other part of the state for economic development and through extension. And then $2.5 million would be for Rapid Ag Response Fund. And we have a number of things that are on the horizon. Hopefully they would never get to Minnesota or never get to the United States, but there are some things that we're concerned about, being African swine fever being one of those issues, that if we have that disease hit the United States, that would mean the depopulation of all of our pork industry. So that's a deep concern. We've heard much about chronic wasting disease, and many people are concerned about that. So that's in there. Emerald ash borer is another one where, you know, it's decimating the forest and the trees. So it's so that's what we're trying to do is, you know, I'm not necessarily these don't necessarily have to be the four things that we would do, but I want to make sure that people understand that $10 million is an increase, which in the overall scheme of things is a really small amount. Even though it's a significant amount, it's still fairly small, but it would be very significant in the kind of work that it would do, and it would be very helpful to be able to see the increase and actually the getting back up to $52 million nearly $53 million would take us back to what we had 10 years ago in the ag specials. So I'm just requesting that we move that back up. And as you said, a number of these other things are still what would have been in the current, the remainder of the money is what is currently in statute for how those are used in the Agriculture and Extension Service.
Thank you, Representative.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rumbeck.
So some of the stuff that the money will be funding is new. Some of it is a continuation of what's been done in the past, but the money's coming through a different route, So not through the Department of Ag, instead through the U of M.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Rumbeck. That is correct. So these aren't necessarily new initiatives. They are adding to what the funds are for those initiatives, and they are being directly routed through the university, through the Ag Special, and wouldn't be routed through the Department of Ag. And I think that, you know, there can be discussion about that as well. But to me, since I'm the chair of the Ag Committee, I think that it seems to be a cleaner route to actually increase the Ag Special through the University of Minnesota, because that otherwise we're doing a pass-through through the Department of Ag. And sometimes that's appealing, and we want to do that. I would think even Mr. Clavin would say that sometimes, you know, it's okay because agriculture might want to have their fingers in that or their eyes on that. But in this case, it seems like it would be appropriate to have this go to the university in this way.
Okay, I understand. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Chair, or Vice Chair and Chair. Representative Poppe, you know that this project is a passion of mine and that it's an outstanding program at the University of Minnesota. It is multiple decades in the making. The program really needs more than $6 million in each fiscal year. And I would ask that if we are going to try to move this bill through the ag or through the education, that we really talk about the funds that the program truly needs. And we have been investing in this program, as I said, for decades. It is now through proof of concept. It is now really to a place where it can go into the farmers' fields and provide this additional income. And it is at a place where it can bring value to our businesses in Minnesota. So I just want to make sure that the committee understands the importance and relevance of this project. And I would like to see it go through food and agriculture. That would be my first choice. The University of Minnesota has additional requests that need to be funded also through this committee. But I do believe that this program is so vital and so important, not only to the large entities, but also to the small ones and to our farmers. And I would encourage everyone in this committee to support the work and research that comes from the University of Minnesota.
And but I will remind members, we are rapidly coming to a close. And okay, unless we want to recess and come back. So we'll keep that in mind. And then that we'll still be open for a public testimony if anybody wants to testify. But Representative Poppe.
And just to that point, Representative Claiborne, I have long supported Forever Green. I've been on the Ag Committee since its inception for us to be able to provide some funding to that. So that's without a doubt. I certainly do support that. I will direct people's attention to 2.1 and 2.2. I'm also stating that to the greatest extent practicable, the Board of Regents must match the funding specified under these clauses in order to have non-state money. And much like that you were stating, it would be, we do have the opportunity to have checkoff dollars be able to use for that. I know that General Mills is very interested in doing some things. You know, we have a number of larger companies that maybe would be interested in being able to provide some matching dollars as well. So I agree. I think it would be important to be able to provide funding, and I look forward to being able to do that. It's just the other thing is the ag budget is much smaller than the higher ed budget. And let me make a point as well to all of the higher ed people that are in the audience as well as the committee members. I'm actually asking that this be separate from the target that you get, because I think it's important for us to actually target this for the ag specials. But I believe that the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State and the higher ed budget needs to be a target that is as large as possible. I don't want this to carve out the money that you should be getting for that budget. I would like this in addition. That is a great ask for the people that are determining those targets, but that is the ask. I think that this is an important thing, and so I'd like to be able to see it move through the right channels and the University of Minnesota Ag Specials. To me, since it has not been increased for 10 years, is the right place to do it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And is there anyone from the audience that would like to give public testimony at this point? Seeing none, Representative Poppe, would you like to renew your motion that House File 1779 be laid over?
I would like to do that.
Thank you.
Oops, there we go. Thank you.
The motion passes. All right. So we have the option of either hearing our last bill of the day, Representative Bernardi's House File 1951, knowing that we probably would go over a little bit beyond our time right now, or that we can recess and come back later. No. Or we can hear part of it. We can begin and go over. All right. If that's fine with the committee members, knowing that we can start, now we'll probably go over, but we will not recess at this point. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Well, let's get started.
We'll do the verbal and nonverbals, so that's good. All right. Representative Bernardi, would you like to move House File 1951 be laid over?
Yes, I would like to move House File 1951 to be laid over.
And I believe there's an author's amendment.
Yes.
Labeled H1951A1 to put the bill in the form that the author wants.
Right. It's yes, I would like to move that amendment, the A1 amendment.
All right. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. All opposed? The motion passes.
Thank you. So I'll be as brief as I can. I want to make sure we get to our testifier.
Chair Bernardi.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill has been in collaboration with my constituent, and we've been working on this together. And I think it's a really important law, and I want to make sure that she's able to share her story and her advocacy for this bill. So just want to let members know that current law requires Minnesota post-secondary institutions to establish written policies on sexual harassment and sexual violence. This bill would require those policies to include an affirmative consent standard as defined in the bill. The bill also changes current law requiring student sexual assault training to incorporate the affirmative consent standard. So with that, I would like to turn it over to my testifier, Ivana Stark.
Thank you. Ms. Stark, if you can state your name again for the record.
My name is Ivana Stark, Chair Pryor, members of the committee. While I'm honored to offer testimony in support of House File 1899, it hurts my heart that we're discussing this in 2019. Working with Representative Bernardi on this bill was an extraordinary experience, and I thank her from the bottom of my heart. Sexual assault and rape is rampant in our state, and I thank the committee for being a part of finding solutions to tackle this problem head on. Minnesota can be a leader in this area. As a mother, a school board member, community leader, former university employee, and a sexual assault survivor, I cannot emphasize the importance of this bill enough. As a survivor of a violent assault, I think back to the night more than I care to admit. I vividly remember the cold concrete under my head and the heavy pressure of my assaulter's weight. I remember his hands tighten my hair and every single thud my head took into the floor. I also remember the fear trapped in my throat. I was afraid that if I cried out, I would be in trouble for what was happening to me. I immediately took blame and embraced the shame because that's what our culture teaches women to do. I must have asked for it. I shouldn't have worn that outfit. I shouldn't have had so much to drink. I should not have let myself be alone with him. I'm 35 years old and my entire life has been full of messages telling women that we should expect it, that it just happens, and that once it's over, we should just move on. Such attacks affect women's mental health for the rest of their lives. Sexual assault changes how a woman exists, how they interact with others, how they maintain relationships, and how they parent. And the very raw feeling you carry around with you never quite goes away. You never stop looking over your shoulder. Far too often, ignorance about the moment is used as a defense. Responses such as, he, she, they wanted it, or they didn't say no, or they started it, seems to be on a constant loop of repetition by offenders. It is important that all institutes of higher learning in Minnesota offer training during orientation that focuses on what affirmative consent actually means. In 2015, the Minnesota Office of Higher Education reported 236 sexual assaults on college campuses. This number does not reflect the unreported number of victims too frightened to come forward. For many, this bill may result in the first time a person is empowered to really say no. It may be the first time that a potential assaulter is educated on what affirmative consent means. This bill has the potential to protect all of Minnesota's college students and young people. It has the potential to truly save lives. This House file is the next step in making systematic change work towards protecting countless people from a moment that will haunt them for the rest of their lives. Supporting this bill is the right thing to do, and I ask for your support. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions from members? At this point, is there anybody from the audience that would like to testify? Questions from members? Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question about kind of the enforcement of this. And the determination of that consent. I mean, oftentimes things become a he said, she said kind of situation. And I'm just wondering, and maybe it's in here and I just didn't see it, but could you just tell me how that would be determined?
Okay, well, to be clear, our bill is not asking the university to change how they do enforcement. This is to say, in the training that you currently do regarding sexual assault training, you need to include this the definition of affirmative consent. So it's silent on how university handles their policies as far as enforcement or any of that. So it's status quo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so then just another question about that. So is the training for the staff and faculty and or the students or everybody included, or kind of how is the training?
Right.
Chair Bernardi.
And thank you, Vice Chair Pryor. We could probably ask our Mr. Hopkins on that. It doesn't change anything that the university already currently trains, but I believe there is an inclusive training for students, and he can just say what the current law is as far as any additional training.
Madam Chair and members, so the training requirements begin on page 2, line 19 of the bill. The change that is there at 2.32 regards training for categories of students. So that begins in paragraph B there on 2.19. So this change, which would require training on the affirmative consent standard, that's contained in the bill would apply to the training that is mandated for students.
Thank you. Representative Poppe, further questions? Or thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just have a series of questions for the bill author. As I'm looking at this, first question is line 1.11. Is there a definition for sexual activity that you're intending or that you're pointing to an existing statute?
Chair Bernardi, or would you like to ask, should we have Mr. Hopkins?
Yes, Mr. Hopkins, could you please respond to that?
Madam Chair and members, so this statute does not have a definition of sexual activity.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then I am aware that criminal sexual conduct is statutorily defined, so both contact, criminal sexual contact, and penetration. So that's clearly defined. But then could you, since it is not defined, I guess the question would be to the bill author, what is your intent for sexual activity? Where are the boundaries of that? Because it could be an eye of the beholder, and the continuum of sexual activity could be one person may consider sexual activity, another person may not. So what the question is, what is your intent on what the definition would be?
Chair Bernardi?
Well, I'm getting my constituent over here is advising me, but frankly, entering in sexual activity needs to be consensual by both parties. So, current statute does talk about penetration, and Mr. Hopkins may be able to add to that.
Mr. Hopkins?
Madam Chair, members, so the criminal code does contain definitions of sexual contact, sexual penetration. Those don't apply to this bill. This bill is within the higher ed statute, so the criminal code's definitions don't apply. As I said previously, this section of law does within the higher ed chapter doesn't contain any definition of sexual activity.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think that's my point, is would kissing then be considered part of the sexual activity as defined in, or as you have listed here?
Chair Bernardi. Vice Chair Pryor and Representative Lucero, I would say sexual activity is, sexual contact with somebody, and I would say kissing is sexual contact, and it needs to be welcome and confirm consent.
Follow-up questions, Representative
A series of follow-up questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And then we'll have Representative Gomez also has a question.
Okay, so, and that's just one example. So the continuum can be pretty wide. So that's, I think, it's a very vague term, and a person may engage in an activity that they themselves may not consider to be sexual activity that another party may. So I think there's a potential room for some miscommunication in this sense, since the term isn't defined. The next question that I would have is, why did you delete the words in the author's amendment or actions in your definition of consent? So it would now read, consent must be given by words.
Chair Bernardi.
Because I believe that's I chose to take out actions because there could be misinterpretations of actions. And I believe that if somebody asks for consent and someone verbally gives it back, then that's affirmative consent.
Representative Lucero, you have further questions?
Series of questions, Madam Chair. So, and the reason I'm asking that question is when I look in the criminal code 609, specifically 609.341, consent is defined, means words or overt actions by a person indicating, etc. Mm-hmm. So this definition now of consent, as in this bill, conflicts with the definition in existing statute in the criminal code.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think there could create a conflict now or a misunderstanding of confusion with a statutory definition of criminal conduct and consent versus you've just changed it, and the policy would be different than what the criminal code is.
Representative Lucero, though, I think we have established that this is in a different part of statute than the criminal code.
Madam Chair, yes, we have established that, But a student that's attending a college that is familiar with the criminal code would have that in their head, and now a policy that would be conflicting with the statutory definition can create confusion. Madam Chair, is my point. Continuing on, there is a definition of coercion, a definition of intimidation that is used on, those words are used on line 1.12. Flipping over to the next page, there are statutory definitions in the criminal code on line 2.3 for the words mental incapacitation, physical impairment, physical helplessness. And so there's a lot of these words that I'm seeing in the criminal code already that make this activity illegal. And so I have concern that this policy is creating some redundancy for activity and actions that are already criminal in nature. And it's, and I'm, as I heard the very unfortunate testimony of the testifier, it's terrible that you had to endure that, and my heart goes out to you. But as I'm listening to the story, that clearly was criminal activity already. And then the next question would be the scope. As Representative Poppy was asking, is this intended for students or staff or both? And the answer was just students. So in the case of, let's say, a married couple, I got married at 19. I was in college. Would this apply to a married couple if they were attending college? Would they have to get affirmative consent to engage in this activity?
Representative Bernardi.
I would like to Mr. Hopkins.
Nonpartisan.
I have my ideas what it would mean, but I will go. I will ask him.
Madam Chair and members, so the school's sexual assault policy applies to the students that attend the school, the staff and faculty that are employed by the school, and the school is going to enforce the policy. So in terms of enforcement, the school is the responsible party for that, so they decide the scope of enforcement for their institution.
Further questions? Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I heard some snickering from that side when I asked that question, and I'm not understanding why, because consent, as defined in the statute, would include, as I described, implied actions. And for a married couple, per this language, you've removed that. It's not actions for a married couple. And if a couple is attending the college and they're students, now you've removed that, and it has to be words only. So I think there's confusion, and so I'm not understanding why they're snickering on that side. But
Representative Lucero, I think maybe Mr. Hopkins should repeat his answer about that. You said it's the policy about sexual assault that the campus has, and that doesn't change the policy that the campus has. Can you repeat your answer again?
Madam Chair and members, so the school is responsible for enforcing the sexual assault policy that's required under this section of law, so the school decides the scope of the policy in terms of enforcements and how it goes about making those kinds of determinations.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. Okay, further questions, Representative Lucero.
Madam Chair, I do have more, but I'll leave it right there and perhaps ask them later. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. And Representative Gomez, you had a question.
It's not really a question. I guess I'm thankful to the author for bringing this forward. This effort is designed to address, a really unacceptable level of sexual assault on campus. That's what we're going for here. We're not establishing new standards for criminal behavior. We're not changing anything in that statute as was established. It's not redundant to ask our institutions of higher education where people have been suffering from like really an epidemic of sexual assault and inaction from institutions. It's not unacceptable for us to ask them to institute a policy around affirmative consent to make sure that the representatives of the university are aware of that and that they have defined what that is for the purposes of determining whether a student is in compliance with the code of conduct. And so, you know, I really think that you know, we have to be careful about conflating things that are not in this bill. Like this is really about asking institutions to be accountable for the history of assault on their campuses, and to be really clear about the training piece. So thank you so much for bringing this forward, Chair.
Thank you. And I believe we have Representative Lehman next.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I know that people are anxious to get going. This is a really tough subject, but I'm always hesitant to quickly put things into state statute. And so my question is, as I'm reading through the materials here, it looks like, you know, we have purview over the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota State Colleges, and it looks like those colleges all have this language in their policy manuals now and are conducting the training. So my question to you, maybe Chair Bernardi, is why would you want to kind of double up and put this in state statutes if this is already happening across all the campuses?
Chair Bernardi.
Okay, I would like to clarify the question from Representative Lehman. Are you saying that all of our universities across the state, two-year colleges, four-year colleges, have affirmative consent in their training that they do?
Representative Lehman.
Oh, Madam Chair. Vice Chair, Chair Bernardi.
Yes.
correct me if I'm wrong. That was my understanding, is that the Minnesota State College System and the University of Minnesota have this policy.
Chair Bernardi.
So, Mr. Hopkins, could you please respond to that? Are you aware of all the policies across the state, including affirmative action?
Madam Chair and members, no, I'm not familiar with every institution's policy. I do believe that the University of Minnesota, and I don't know if it's on a campus-by-campus basis for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities or if it's system-wide, but I do know that some of them have affirmative consent policies, at least some of the campuses do. Private institutions, I believe some of them definitely have affirmative consent policies. I can't say for sure that all of them do, but it is true that this statute applies to our public institutions, the University of Minnesota, Minnesota State, and it also applies to private post-secondary institutions that offer in-person classes on campus in Minnesota. But I can't say whether all of them already have an affirmative consent policy or not.
Representative Lehman.
Okay, Madam Chair. So, Chair Bernardi, so what I'm hearing you say is you're not certain that all colleges have this, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are you saying that the reason you're putting it into state law is to require all that maybe don't have it in their policy to insert it in their policy? Or what do you see happening that's different as a result of this law?
Thank you, Madam Chair, that everyone at all our universities and colleges would have this in their purview and it's included.
Right, and
okay, that'll conclude my questions. Thank you,
Representative Rombeck.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. So, I see that MNSCU had adopted a yes means yes policy last year, and so I would think that you have to have some kind of enforcement piece as part of that. So, if somebody feels like I didn't say yes, but you did it anyway. What is the expectation? I mean, what are the colleges supposed to do about that behavior? I don't know if anyone from MNSCU is here who could describe that. Tell us.
Chair Bernardi? Do we have a testifier that can address the issue? Please take
Madam
your name for the
Chair, and, my name is Chris Hawling. I am the
Minnesota State System Director for Student Financial Aid. As such, this isn't really my area of expertise, but one of our staff who was intending to be here had to leave to attend to a family situation and instructed me that if this question came up, I was to say that we are, in fact, on all of our campuses, are, in fact, in compliance with what this requires. And anything beyond that, I may have to defer in terms of getting back to you in answer to a question. But I did want to make that clear, since you asked if someone was here, that is what I was told.
And we could perhaps answer other questions offline if we don't have that information available right now.
I think we need to have an idea of how it will be implemented. And, you know, if somebody violates the consent, what happens?
That level of detail, I'm sorry, I'm sure it's addressed in the institutional procedures, but they're not my area. I don't know exactly what they say.
Madam Chair, this is silent on how the university, how they would enforce it. It's status quo on what they currently, how they currently enforce their policies. Mm-hmm. So thank you for having these policies in your institutions.
Thank you, Chair Bernard. Mm-hmm. Representative Franson.
Thank you. A couple of things. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like that a student could get expelled from school for violation of this policy, even if that policy is not against the law within the criminal statute, since that criminal statute does not line up with this bill. So could you just explain how that would work?
Madam Chair, Representative Franson, I am not familiar with the expulsion policies at our state, at our universities.
Well, these are
Representative Franson.
These are important questions that, you know, to the chair here too. I guess I was a little disturbed when Representative Lucero was asking his questions, and he had a line of questionings, and I felt like he was being rushed in his answers and interrupted. And so I would hope that Representative Lucero could continue asking his questions without feeling rushed or being smirked at. Because I think he has important things to add.
Representative Lucero, further questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess to the point that Representative Franzen just brought up, where the policy having with the author's amendment, and I'm just going to reiterate this fact, the author's amendment now removes the words "or actions." And current statutory definition in the criminal sexual conduct portion of our law reads, consent means words or overt actions. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm asking the question, as somebody who was married when I was young and attending college, if I engage in this activity, if a married couple engages in the activity that is not consent given by words, but is consent given by overt actions, are they now subject to whatever the ramifications are of the school's policy when they've followed the law?
Mr. Hopkins, could you more of a technical
Mr.
question?
Madam Chair, members, I really can't address that particular situation. Again, it's up to each school to decide how it's going to enforce this policy. It is true that the bill no longer contains the words "actions," so it is correct to say that consent has to be given by words, words only, and actions, overt or otherwise, no longer qualify for affirmative consent under the bill after as amended.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is it the bill author's intention that affirmative consent must be written, or can it be verbal only?
Chair Bernardi.
Yes, Vice Chair Pryor. It can be verbal, and I would be happy to work on this. I'm not totally against putting overt actions in there. I decided that words was important, but I would be happy to work with you on incorporating that if we further talk about it and makes the bill more more clear and helps it advance it. So that's something I'd be willing to talk with you about.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that, those words from the bill author. And again, I'm just going to, and I'll end with this, Madam Chair, and that is, this is a serious line of questioning. And when I was asking my serious questions, I'm really dismayed when I'm hearing that side of the committee offer these snickers as if it's some kind of a mocking attitude. And I just would urge members of this committee to take this seriously. So thank you.
All right. And Representative Lucero, clearly no, if there is a perception of mock, then an apology. I know that I certainly believe in the seriousness of your line of question. I will speak for myself and as chair and as someone presiding over this meeting that that would be totally inappropriate to do. And that was not, and that should not be something that happens in a committee member meeting, that you should feel that way. So I will endeavor to do better as a chair that would not happen in the future. Thank you, Representative Lucero, for addressing this again. And Representative Brumbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think there are a lot of questions and not complete answers, and I would urge us to lay this over or whatever. At this point, I just don't feel like we have a bill that we'd be ready to act on.
And the motion is to lay it over.
Lay it over.
And perhaps Representative Bernardi, a summary up and of the questions and the issues that have been raised, and closing words.
Okay, I thought I saw a hand over here on this side, one last hand, but I
apologize. Okay. I didn't look over here.
Okay.
But Representative Gomez.
So I guess I just wanted to say that I'm sitting over here and my perception wasn't that there was smirking or snickering going on. I think that I heard like four or five of us audibly say yes when the question was asked, should this apply to a married couple? So I just wanted to clarify that. There was not ever an intention to mock or discredit the line of questioning, at least not for me, and I guess that was what I heard over here. I know that, you know, that it can be, you know, maybe that wasn't what you heard or that you didn't hear audibly that people were saying, yes, that should apply to married couples. And so apologies if it came off as smirking or snickering. That certainly wasn't my intent, and I don't think that it was the intent of the other members, so apologies to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Gomez. And Chair Bernardi.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This is a very serious issue, and this bill, just to reiterate it, there's already current laws that are requiring the established written policies on sexual harassment and sexual violence. This would require the policy to include an affirmative consent standard, and it would require that the sexual assault training that's already required by our institutions, that affirmative consent is that it includes affirmative consent standard. So I appreciate it.
Chair Minardi, Representative Claiborne did have a question earlier, and she was able to return the committee. And you're good.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right.
Okay.
Please proceed.
So thank you very much, members, and I look forward to working on getting this bill included in language that will move forward this session, because I feel it's very important.
Hearing no further discussion, Representative Bernardi will renew the motion that House File 1951, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education Omnibus Bill. The motion passes. And we are adjourned.